Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. What makes a book worthy of being called a great American novel? Is it the writing quality? Is it a story that almost any American can read and relate to? Or a book that holds a mirror up to a moment in history? The writer John William DeForest defined it as a work of fiction that accomplishes, quote, the task of painting the American soul. This hour, we're going to explore how writers at The Atlantic defined the great American novel. The magazine just released its list of books written in the last 100 years. We're discussing, debating, and dissecting the great American novel, and we're starting off with Gal Beckerman, a senior editor for books at The Atlantic. Welcome to All Sides.
Thanks for having me.
First off, why did The Atlantic feel this was an important project to take on?
Good question. I think probably it was as much a thought that this would be a fun project to take on as that it was important because, you know, obviously the idea of establishing a new canon is a fairly like audacious undertaking. But what seemed interesting to us was actually the process of thinking through what would it mean to look back over, we chose 100 years, we can talk a little bit about that, but 100 years seemed to us a period of time in which the canon itself is fluid, right? You're deciding what stays and what goes and what's sort of still staying with people and that we can imagine them reading in 30, 40, 100 years. So we decided that it would be sort of an interesting exercise to sit and decide and draw on experts too to figure out sort of what books would fit in that category.
And what I loved about it is you didn't use the words like the best American novels
right.
or the greatest mm-hmm. of the great American novels. You had this description that I want to read for folks. We hope to replicate that particular way. Oh, sorry. I am screwing that up already. mm-hmm. We hope to replicate that particular joy of a friend pressing a book into your hand and saying, you have to read this. You'll love it. And I love that characterization of how we're going to define the list.
That's right. I mean, we didn't really want to feel that this was a dutiful list. You know, there's plenty of other places that you can go for that. People probably remember the books they had to read in high school or middle school as being sort of books on that dutiful list. We wanted to really use a few different measures, right? We wanted these books to really have literary quality that stood up, that we felt that still felt that they read well, and we wanted books that sort of might be trying something new, that maybe were experimental in their moment in terms of breaking the mold of what a novel could do. And we wanted books that sort of had that ambition that to tell an American story, a big story, to sort of capture something essential about our national character, you know, in all of its very many different forms. And then on top of all of that, we just wanted a good book. You know, we wanted, you know, I know people now who are like making their way through this list, which is an endeavor in itself, but I feel kind of confident with that project because I know that, you know, not all these books will be to everyone's taste, but they are definitely books that are all, you know, compelling to read and spend time with.
And though you looked at 100 years, you didn't limit yourself to 50 or 100 books. There's actually 136 titles on the list.
Yes. We knew this would be a controversial decision, or maybe even just a confusing one, which is that, you know, the obvious thing would have been to go with a nice round number of 100. But we sort of gave ourselves the chance to just go as long as we wanted and sort of stop when it felt right, when the composition of the list in terms of chronologically having a certain number of books in every era, you know, covering ground that we wanted to cover just in terms of the diversity of the country. We kind of got there and we said, you know what, we're done. This is the list and it's going to be 136 books.
Not surprisingly, there's been some big reactions to the picks. But before we debate the actual list, I think we need to define what makes a great American novel, or at least the criteria that you're using for this definition.
Right. So I mentioned a few of them. You know, I think we really wanted books that had ambition to them, you know, books that tried to do something new or something that actually, you know, spoke to you know, the various tensions, aspirations, you know, storylines that sort of course through the bigger American story. And, you know, you can see this throughout the list. Some of these sort of ambitious books are quite obvious. You take a book like, you know, Saul Bellow's The Adventures of Augie March or Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man. You know, those are books where the authors just tried to wrap their arms around the American story. And so that was sort of one of the major criteria for what makes a great American novel. But also there are many kind of, you know, quote unquote, smaller ways to get at that ambition. You know, there's novels that are more stream of consciousness or experimental or what we might call derisively domestic, you know, or sort of auto fiction. You know, there's so many different sort of ways to crack that nut, but we wanted to sort of create a list that had that diversity to it as well.
So let's talk about the list.
Yes.
There were some books on the list that I think most people know and you might just sort of expect to be on the list. So like mm-hmm. The Grapes of Wrath, Catcher in the Rye, The Great Gatsby. And there were some authors like Toni Morrison, Kurt Vonnegut, you know, William Faulkner that you just sort of would assume would be on the list in some form, even if you couldn't pick the right book.
Right.
So were these books or authors where there was like an immediate consensus, like, yes, this author is going to be on the list, or yes, this book has to be there?
So it's interesting. You know, one of the other mixes that we wanted to have, I've been talking about the sort of the way we compose the list, was to have a list that would have sort of a certain kind of authority to it. And I don't think that you can do that unless you put titles on there that people have already established are sort of great American novels. So if The Great Gatsby is not on there, if Invisible Man is not on there, then you're not really, I mean, speaking as a reader, it would be hard for me to take the list seriously. But we wanted to balance that out with a list that had a lot of discovery, a lot of surprise in it, where we sort of revisited, you know, authors that might have been forgotten but shouldn't be, where we wanted that to be really mixed in there. So one of the things we did was take these authors who are really well known and might be obvious for the list, but sort of look at their entire oeuvres, like their entirety of their books, and think about, you know, is the book that's become the book that we know from Toni Morrison, which would be, say, Beloved,
or which is on the list.
It's just on the list, yes. Or from Faulkner. Are those the books that that we want to sort of share with our readers? And in some cases, they weren't. And some of the controversy has come from, like, you know, Hemingway. Like, why did you choose For Whom the Bell Tolls and not, you know, The Sun Also Rises? Because that's my favorite Hemingway book. But we had our rationale, and we thought, you know, let's you know, kind of shift people to certain books within an author's oeuvre.
I think perhaps the most controversial choice to not include was To Kill a Mockingbird. It is not on the list. Can you talk about how you came to that decision?
Yeah, you know, we had a lot of conversations about To Kill a Mockingbird because it is one of those obvious ones. And it was sort of where, you know, the rubber hit the road, so to speak, where we had to kind of decide how we felt, because I think, you know, we've all read it. We all, almost all of America has read it. It's one of those books that everyone reads in middle school that leaves a strong impression that people feel emotionally attached to for that reason. But in revisiting it, it seemed like a wonderful moral sort of parable, but we wondered if the literary quality of it was something that was going to last through all time, if the book had sort of become iconic almost in spite of its particular qualities. And so at the end of the day, we thought, you know, this is a book that sort of serves an important sort of pedagogical purpose, but maybe doesn't belong on our list of great American novels. And so we threw down that gauntlet. I will say, just as sort of an addendum to that, that like the purpose of this list was to get people fighting, you know, was to get people sort of arguing with it. That when I saw that begin to happen, as soon as we published it, I knew that we had done something successful, because people felt like it had enough quality that they wanted it to, you know, to have more of this or less of that, or the writer they love, or why did you, you know, leave this person off? Yeah.
And if you want to fight or argue or talk about the books you love on the Atlantic's 100, 100 years, not 100 books, Great American Novels, you can give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email allsides@wosu.org. And I will not argue with you. I will just merely note that William Faulkner has two books on the list, The Sound and the Fury and Absalom, Absalom, but not Light in August or As I Lay Dying. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I kind of get it, but I would argue that As I Lay Dying is probably his most accessible book. Like, if I was going to give, if I was going to start someone on Faulkner, I'd start with that.
Right. But.
But that doesn't mean it's his greatest, I guess.
No, but this is probably the conversation that we had, if I can remember, because we had many, many conversations, as you can imagine, is, you know, do you want with Faulkner, do you want the most accessible book, or do you want the book that most clearly shows the really radical things that Faulkner was doing in fiction? And so I'd argue that, you know, a book like Sound and the Fury, for example, which is one of, you know, one of the more popular books, like in that it sort of allows him to do the full multi-perspectival thing, you know, and really do this stream of consciousness of the various characters in a way that felt truly groundbreaking, that that sort of best characterizes, you know, Faulkner for our purposes.
Yeah, the multi-person, like multi-POV first-person narrative is really sort of born in Faulkner. Like, I think I think As I Lay Dying has like 15 different POVs. Yes. It's wild.
Yeah. And not, I mean, these aren't easy. Those are not easy. I mean, Faulkner is not, they're not easy books to read, but they're books that are extremely rewarding if you sort of spend time with them.
Yeah. And one of the things that I loved about the Atlantic's Great American Novels list is that on the digital list, you can click on the images of the book covers and learn more about why you chose it or history of the books. And for example, I had no idea that American Tragedy was based on a true story.
Yeah. Yeah. He had spent, I actually wrote that blurb, so I know.
Oh,
I know.
Yeah.
He had spent, Dreiser had spent almost, you know, 10 or 15 years sort of researching this true, what we would today call a true crime story, of a young woman who drowned and while she was with this man that she was dating, and sort of, and then sort of from there unfolded a whole story that he told in the book, epic story.
You also had more recent books on the list, which I thought was a bold move to kind of guess at what might hold the test of time. The most recent one on the list was called Biography of X. It was published in 2023. And I have to say, the little explanation that I clicked on, because I had no idea what it was, convinced me to add it to my TBR. So, like, kudos. But how did you decide with books published in the last 5 or 10 years, which ones you thought would really last?
I have to say that really was the hardest part, because, you know, even with the older books, there is some consensus that is settled around sort of little known books. And we drew a lot on for the books, let's say, you know, beyond the last 20 years, we did draw a lot on experts. We went to like a huge pool of novelists and critics and academics to try to get their ideas of what they thought. And so we were able to do a lot with that. But for the last 15, 20 years, like it was. You know, even those people didn't want to take a gamble, you know. And so what we really had to do was think about, I mean, we're all the group of three or four editors who were sitting around deciding this, you know, we're all people who are deeply immersed in books. And we really had to take a step back and try to do what's almost impossible, I'll admit, which is to say, like, which of these books, you know, not only is sort of pleasing in the moment, but actually does something so revelatory that you can imagine it sort of lasting. And so Biography of X is a wonderful example. It's a book that I was extremely admiring of. Catherine Lacey is the author. It's her fourth novel, I think. And it's very hard to describe. It's sort of a fake biography of an artist who was sort of a shape-shifting kind of artist, by that artist's widow, who's writing about her after her death. And she, the artist who goes by X, was you know, really took on different personas, played around with ideas of identity and sort of performance of identity. And so the book is both this kind of search for who the authentic person is underneath this X, but also really exploring this idea of sort of how our identities are sort of taken on and taken off, which felt to me such a resonant theme for our moment. But she got at it in this totally original way. Like, you know, it's not a book that's like anything you've ever read, which I think could be said for a lot of the books on this list, that, you know, when you read a book and you're like, this feels like something that is very different from anything I've ever read, which was, I think, true of the books that we have in the last like 10 years. Like, take Patricia Lockwood's book. You know, she's a poet, and even just the form of it, you know, which in these little sort of like bits of text, like, just feels really, really new. Yeah.
I'd also say Salvage the Bones is like that. It's about Hurricane Katrina. And I will tell you, it is a wonderful book that I will never read again because it is so dark.
Yes.
But it is not, you got to be in the right, you got to know what you're getting with
mood,
Salvage the Bones.
Mood.
Yeah. You also chose to put genre fiction writers on, which I personally loved. But have you gotten any pushback to the inclusion of authors like Stephen King or Octavia Butler?
You know, we haven't, which I feel very gratified by, because I do think one of the things, you know, when you do this exercise, if you look over a period of 100 years, you see what's changed too. And one of the things that's changed is the sort of respectability of a certain kind of genre writing that plays around with genre, that is sort of doing it at the highest level. And so we definitely wanted to put that on there. The other thing we put on there that maybe was surprising, but I thought was lovely and was really important to me, was like young adult or children's literature.
Yeah, Wrinkle in Time was a great choice.
Yes, Wrinkle in Time. We have Judy Blume's Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. We have Charlotte's Web on there. And we have two or three graphic novels.
Yeah, I loved to see that. Graphic novels get like a bad rap, I think, sometimes.
And they really are quite, I mean, they're working the one that we had, that's the thing most recent, is called Sabrina. And it's an extraordinary work. I mean, it stands up against like any of the major novels of the last 20 years.
Yeah. And I also, you know, if they used to say that the funny pages was the gateway to reading the newspaper. And I think for a lot of young readers, graphic novels are the gateway into books as they grow up.
For sure. I have two young daughters who are, you know, crazy about graphic novels. And it has literally been the gateway for them, you know, into novels, more complex novels.
Final question for you. Why is it important to believe in the great American novel?
This is a good question. And I thought about this. You know, I don't actually think of a kind of a platonic ideal of a, you know, a canon of great American novels. I don't think that exists. You know, I think it's one of these things, you know, like the concept of like, you know, objectivity or something that you sort of strive for, but you never get at. But it's in the striving that the actual like value of it emerges. And so for me, you know, trying to create this list was about working towards some collection of books that would capture who we are, you know, as a nation, as a people, which is a concept that's always changing, always being added to, always being shifted and adjusted and reassessed. And you see that reflected in the books. And so, you know, going through the exercise of, you know, actually taking in, you know, adding books, taking them out, reading these books again, I think is just a wonderful sort of collective act, you know, that we can all do that makes us feel connected to each other.
That was Gal Beckerman, senior editor for books at The Atlantic. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
And I definitely recommend checking out The Atlantic's list of the great American novels. You can search for it, or you can find a link to it on WOSU.org. Coming up, we're getting opinions on the list from two of Ohio's local booksellers and a librarian from the Columbus Metropolitan Library. And we want your opinion as well. What makes a great American novel? Do you agree with the list? Give us a call at 614-292-8513. Your opinions coming up when All Sides continues.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Sometimes the whole point of a list is to debate it, and we've invited some book lovers to help us debate, discuss, and dissect The Atlantic's new list of great American novels. Joining us now is Linda Cass, founder and owner of Gramercy Books in Bexley. She's also the author of 3 historical novels. Welcome to All Sides, Linda.
Thank you, Anne.
Dan Brewster, the owner of Prologue Bookshop in the Short North. Welcome, Dan.
Thank you.
And Carolyn Nims, the Youth Services Librarian at the Columbus Metropolitan Library. Welcome.
Happy to be here.
I want to start by asking each of you for your definition of the great American novel. And Carolyn, I'll put you in the hot seat first.
Sure. I really wrestled with this one. Naturally, this is a subjective question and a broad one. So my answer is a little subjective, a little broad. A great American novel, it's a work of highly engaging fiction that is written artfully, that has a truth or truths that resonate with an aspect of the American experience. The story in some way examines the question of what it means to be American.
That's a great one. Dan?
Thank you.
Yeah, my answer is a little bit broader even than that, in that I look at it as a book that attempts to represent the American experience. And I think that there's a lot of complexity with that, because when this term has been used, you know, over the last 100 years, it often has been implied somehow that there is one American experience that can be represented in a book, and that somehow that is something that can be captured. And I think that is one of the basis for the challenges around defining it now, is that there are so many American experiences, and how could you ever possibly encapsulate those into one book? It's a really interesting challenge, though.
Linda?
I would say, and I agree with what both Dan and Carolyn said about their definition. I'd say it's a powerful story, beautifully told, that portrays a period of our American culture in a way that's relatable and stands the test of time. I also think a great American novel as one that expands your sense of yourself and the world, and one that is masterful in scale and in vision.
Those are all great definitions. I think the only thing I'd add is I think there are books about, like, what makes a book great, at least for me, is the resonance, like the connection. So we don't have to have the same lived experiences as the characters. We don't even have to like the characters sometimes. But something about the protagonist in particular has to speak to something inside of us. Like, it needs to resonate. Does that make sense?
I think it definitely resonates. The thing that becomes challenging is that each of us have our own experience and our own lens in how we see things. And so you can have the same book, just like you can have the same, you know, piece of art, and two people look at it and they see different things and they relate to it in different ways. So,
yeah. And I think that's why there's so much debate about The Atlantic's list. Because, you know, you might look at it and say, gosh, why is my favorite book not on it? Or why on earth did they include this one but not that one? So let's get into the list a little bit. Were there any books that really surprised you in, like, a good way or in a, like, oh, okay?
Generally speaking, I was pleasantly surprised by the diversity. I thought, especially when it came to the newer books, I was happy to see The Atlantic, like, putting their stake in the ground and claiming that these books will resonate for years to come. I was also pleasantly surprised to see children's books on there, particularly Charlotte's Web.
Yeah.
I know that's one of Linda's favorites, too.
Yes, it absolutely is. At the bookstore, we have a favorite tower, and it's on my favorite tower.
And I think that's one of those books that you can read as an adult. It's definitely targeted to children, but it was fun to reread as a grown adult.
Absolutely. I read it recently within the last couple of years, and I ugly cried.
They also had Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, which I definitely read as a child. And I think it was recently made into a motion picture.
Mm-hmm. Haven't seen it.
I have not either, but the book I really loved. But what I found really interesting is they didn't drop down to like picture books, right? They cut a line. I wouldn't call it a middle grade line, but they definitely, so like Where the Wild Things Are didn't make the cut and that kind of thing.
Arguably, it could be because they're not what you'd think of as traditional novels.
Yeah, I think so. I think that you have to sort of define how young you're going to go when you include children on the list.
I was excited to see the book Oreo by Fran Ross on the list. This is a book that was written in the 70s and fell out of print for a number of years and recently came back into print. And it's a really interesting coming-of-age story about a young woman who kind of makes her way to New York City and explores the city and does just a lot of really fascinating things. And Fran Ross was a Black author who really got no one knew about her during her lifetime. And the book is a really interesting and really funny book. And it's exciting to see it has come back to some prominence all these years later.
You know, I really also, I think, concurring when Carolyn said the diversity of the list, you know, we had obviously the Great Gatsby on there. Everyone would have expected that to be on there, and certainly The Grapes of Wrath. There were several books by James Baldwin. I really was glad that they included Giovanni's Room. A portrait of a man really torn between a woman and another man, really groundbreaking at the time it was published in the 1950s.
Yeah, they also had Nightwood, which was published in 1936. And I think it's one of the first novels, popular novels, to really portray lesbian relationships. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there was a lot of like diversity of authors, diversity of perspectives. What I also thought was really interesting is they had some coming to America books, which I kind of loved, right? The immigrant experience or the view when like America is fresh and new and different.
Absolutely. The idea of American never was a monolith, and it certainly isn't today. And it was nice to see the list accommodate a vast array of American experiences.
And if you want to talk about the list, if you have a favorite book that was or was not on the Atlantic's Greatest American Novels list, you can give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email allsides at wosu.org. You know, some of the books on the list attempted to capture a specific moment in our history. So Salvage the Bones by Jesmyn Ward takes place in Mississippi during Hurricane Katrina. And it's a very, you know, specific book about those days. And it is a beautiful book. But like I said earlier, it's a book that I will probably never read again because of how heavy it is. And for anyone who has trouble with animal abuse, it's maybe not the book for you at all. But it really is a fascinating and unique perspective on that particular moment in our history. Do you guys have any favorites on the list? I know you said Oreo. Were there other books that you were like, yes?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this list was full of favorites and so many books that I'm like, I really should have read that by now. Another one I really enjoyed, though, was Lincoln and the Bardo by George Saunders.
Yeah, I think I had that, too. I went through the list, and I don't know if you guys did, but I counted up all the ones that I'd read, and I came out with 20, and I was like, ooh, I got a lot of reading to do.
I think I came out with about 20 to 25 as well. And obviously, a lot of us probably read these books as teenagers and probably without those click-ins that they had on that article where you could read about the book, you had to kind of refresh your memory of things that the book was all about.
Yeah, like The Great Gatsby, Catcher in the Rye. Like, those are the books that you definitely read. Well, Catcher in the Rye, I feel, is like that book that if it's sentimental to you, it's probably because you read it as an angsty teenager.
It definitely made me feel seen as an angsty teenager.
Yeah, I think that's because there's been some pushback to including Catcher in the Rye, but I'm like, I will defend it only because I think it's sentimental to me based on the time that I read it.
You know, one book that I absolutely loved, and I was thrilled that it was on here, was Jennifer Egan's A Visit from the Goon Squad. Really a book that was quite experimental in the way it dealt with time. And she even had a PowerPoint chapter, which was, you know, just very different. And I just was thrilled that that was on the list.
Yeah, actually, House of Leaves was on the list. And I will say that is a book that if you want to read, you should not get the Kindle version. You should absolutely go to a place like Gramercy Books or Prologue and get the physical copy, because I don't know really how to explain House of Leaves. It's so, the book has like swirling text and images, and like, you know, so much of the time a book is supposed to be like the words are supposed to disappear and you create this like movie in your head. But House of Leaves, like the way the type is set out, is so critical to how you understand the story. And it's such a different book, which is maybe why they put it on the list.
Definitely one of those ambitious ones that the Gall was talking about.
Yeah, I can't imagine like being a book editor and getting that as a submission and being like, what am I going to do with this? You know, I want to ask you a question more generally about how these lists are built and constructed and how they change over time. Do you think there's a value in making these kinds of lists, sort of creating these canons of whether it's just great novels, great American novels?
Well, as you said, you know, we all agree that there's a lot of disagreement. You know, I think, though, putting lists like this together get us talking. Thank you for doing this program, for example. Talking about books is a wonderful thing and getting people more interested in books and reading. We learn so much. So, you know, while it does aggravate some people because of their favorite books that aren't on here, I think that this is a very valuable exercise.
That was Linda Cass, founder and owner of Gramercy Books in Bexley, Ohio. Coming up, we're continuing our conversation on the Atlantic's list of great American novels. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're hosting a little bit of our own book club this morning as we discuss the Atlantic's list of the great American novels. They selected 136 titles, mostly adult books. Still with us is Linda Cass, founder and owner of Gramercy Books in Bexley, Dan Brewster, owner of Prologue Bookshop in the Short North, and Carolyn Nims, youth services librarian for the Columbus Metropolitan Library. So, Carolyn, during the break, you and I were chatting about sort of the lack of YA novels on this list.
Yeah, absolutely. It was great to see Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. That was absolutely revelatory when I was young. I would have liked to see perhaps The Perks of Being a Wallflower.
Mm.
That has resonated with a lot of millennials,
really,
for instance. Very good book. And perhaps a more recent classic, The Hate U Give.
Oh.
I was surprised that wasn't on there. And this is more of an adult book, but The House on Mango Street by Sandra Cisneros. Why not that?
Those are all good questions. You know, Linda, we were also talking about, you know, why they made certain choices about certain authors. So, you know, Ernest Hemingway is obviously on the list. I think any list that didn't include him would have been a little strange. But Old Man and the Sea, I mean, I don't know if it's cliche, but like it wasn't on there.
Yeah, I had that on as well, Anna. Also, The Sun Also Rises, two of his, well, so many of his books are so wonderful. I just think that the choices were obviously challenging for the folks at the Atlantic. But there, you know, there were some other choices. I clicked on to some things. I know they chose Couples by John Updike. And, you know, if you look into some of this stuff, and you can get into the weeds when you start researching it, but The Maple Stories was considered at the time a more enduring emblem emblem of American adultery and divorce than Couples, but you know, they chose Couples. So there's a lot of different, we don't all agree on all this.
And Dan, I want to talk about the most controversial choice here, which was that they did not include To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yeah, it is such an interesting choice. And I know that you were talking about that in the earlier segment. And I know with lists like this, they are so eager to spur discussion that I wonder sometimes if they make a choice just to be like, oh, you know, that's the thing everyone's going to talk about is why there wasn't that book on there. Because I think whether it has, you know, regardless of quote unquote literary qualities it may have, it's such a groundbreaking and important book that so many of us have read. It was something we talked about this list with other booksellers in my store this week, and all of us immediately jumped on that as where is it?
But they did include graphic novels and genre fiction, which I thought was a great choice to be more expansive and more inclusive, including authors like Octavia Butler, which I agree with, and Stephen King. But I was really surprised it was The Stand, if I'm being totally honest. I don't know that I would. I might have picked Misery, possibly, or even Needful Things if I was going to pick a Stephen King book. He has so many, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, it was really neat to see, that with a lot of the genre fiction, just a whole variety of great books on here. The Fifth Season was one I was really excited to see by N.K. Jemisin. Just a terrific series and a terrific book.
Yeah, I think that's the challenge. And I think that's the particular controversy of this list is because it's not 100. It could have been 236 instead of 136. But I guess you got to draw a line somewhere. Carolyn, I would have lobbied hard, I think, though, for The Phantom Tollbooth or maybe The Mixed Up Files of Mrs. Basil E. Frankweiler, but that's only because, like, I read them and loved them so deeply as a child.
I agree. I considered, should The Phantom Tollbooth should have been on here? And I wondered if it didn't speak enough about being American.
If it was too, like, fantasy-driven?
Maybe, because it's so wrapped up in that fantasy world. Maybe the Americanness of it didn't resonate as much. That would be my guess as to why it's not on there. But it's a fabulous book. I agree.
Yeah, we didn't really see any full-blown fantasy novels. We did see some political novels, like All the King's Men. You could call it the great American political novel. Although I read on their little blurb, or was somewhere else, that Robert Penn Warren said that he didn't set out to write a book about politics. And I'm like, but it is a book about politics. Although in that vein, though, I was kind of surprised that like Margaret Atwood and The Handmaid's Tale didn't make the cut. And, oh, Linda?
Yeah, absolutely. However, what they indicated is the book had to be first published in the United States, and Margaret Atwood's book was first published in Canada.
Oh.
So it missed the list just for that reason, probably.
Yeah, but there was some controversy with, like, Lolita, though, right?
And The Bell Jar, wasn't that published first in England?
But I think she intended. I think that's what they said as a justification.
Yeah, that it was intended. You know, because Mrs. Dalloway, I mean, it's on every syllabus for any, literary piece of work. And it also was first published in the UK. My personal favorites, I love Kazuo Ishiguro, but all of his books are first published in the UK. So, you know, those kind of books didn't make the list.
Yeah, like Fahrenheit 451 made it. But then I had forgotten that like 1984 and Animal Farm were UK. I forgot. And I was like, oh, okay, that's right. That makes sense.
Yeah.
That's the limitation of limiting it to American. And also limiting it to novels also silences some great American voices like Truman Capote. He wrote novels, but he's better known for his, nonfiction.
Yeah, yeah. So Jack Kerouac's On the Road was there, but like Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test was not, because that's nonfiction, even though they kind of are covering the same characters in the same time span. I also thought like Maya Angelou's not on the list because she's autobiographical. Like I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, you would think. Like initially I was like, that should be on the list. And then I was like, oh, wait, it's not a novel. It's an autobiography. So. There is some limitations to that.
You know, in that vein, though, this is going to be kind of controversial, but I was kind of curious about Ayn Rand being excluded from the list. Sort of like Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged. She was in America when she was writing them. I think they were first published here. And they are about the U.S., so I didn't know. I didn't know how I felt about that.
I wonder whether literary was a kind of a standard they maybe applied to that book. Didn't have beautiful enough prose, perhaps. I don't know.
Apparently that took out To Kill a Mockingbird. So
yeah, exactly. There were some books that I would have loved to see on this list, you know, because they did say that they were including these kind of unknown, you know, lesser known books. And I would say the greatest American novel you've never heard of is a book called Stoner by John Williams. It was a book that blew me away. A lot of people haven't, and I never heard of it had I not had a friend who, you know, is a great reader and told me about it. It was, I believe it was first published in 1965, but sold very few copies. And then it was reissued many years later. And the reason it should be on this list, it's the portrayal of the entire life of one ordinary man named William Stoner. He was a professor of literature, and his attempt to live a life with integrity. It's really one of the most powerful and moving novels that I've ever read. It had no sentimentality, and it was really told, you know, with complete clarity in how it was written, beautifully written, really about love and passion. And I highly recommend it. It should have been on there.
Do either you, Carolyn, or Dan have any books that you think really should have been on there that you feel as passionately about?
I may not feel as passionately about Tree of Smoke by Dennis Johnson, but I was very surprised that it wasn't on there. When I read it years ago, I thought it was, wow, this is a perfect novel. And it did win the National Book Award. So it was interesting to see how some award winners were excluded from this list.
Yeah, I think there was only 20 books that won the Pulitzer Prize on the list. So not a majority or even like a sizable chunk.
I was thinking some of the really recent books that, you know, might be on the list, not to introduce us into dangerous territory. But looking at even the last couple of years, there have been some really, really expansive, wonderful novels published that, from my perspective, I think would have a very good chance of making this list down the road, including Demon Copperhead by Barbara Kingsolver. Mm-hmm. We did note there was no Barbara Kingsolver on the list, which seemed like an omission. And that would be, you know, that has been, I think, her most celebrated book that that she has written. Like, it came out and everyone was just so stunned by it. The Heaven and Earth Grocery Store, the James McBride that came out, has rocketed to the top of all of everyone's best of lists for last year, and just remarkable. And then even more recently, the very recent novel James by Percival Everett, which is a retelling of Huck Finn from the perspective of Jim. And it is a really remarkable achievement. And so I think any of those are ones that could definitely be seen on this list in the future.
Yeah. There's probably a few others that people will, you know, talk about. John Irving, for example, was left out. I know my book buyer loves A Prayer for Owen Meany. I mean, she can't believe, I'm sure, that this book is not included. I agree with Dan. I was wondering about several of Barbara Kingsolver's novels. I was also wondering about Richard Russo and Empire Falls when it came out. You know, it really seemed, you know, won the Pulitzer. It seemed to really explore, you know, family wealth and ambition in a bygone America, you know, set in a blue collar town in Maine. And, you know, it just seemed like it fit into some of the things they talked about, but it wasn't on the list. So
I would have made a case maybe for American Rust by Philip Meyer. Mm-hmm. If you really want to understand, it's set in like a really economically devastated part of Pennsylvania. And it's all about like the lack of hope that people feel and the desperation that they have, and to really understand like what the Rust Belt means and the impact that like trade agreements and things have had here. I think that's like, if you ever wanted to understand that feeling, perhaps that populism that gave rise to President Trump, like that is an excellent book to read. But, you know, I am not the writers of The Atlantic. They make their own choices. But that's what I love about this, is that like you can have a debate and a dialogue about the books that you love, the books that you think should be on the list. And, you know, the Atlantic had that great line that they wanted to share books that made them go, you know, press it into a friend's hand and say, you have to read this. And I love that sentiment. And I love the idea of those books that you just love so much that you have to share with others. So we're coming to the end of the hour. And I wanted to ask, you know, if you had to pick a book right now to press into somebody's hand and say, you have to read this, what would it be?
Babel by R.F. Kuang.
Mm. And why?
Because it takes place in England, but it is a story about power and balance, which are such American concepts too. Very important questions here and now. It's fantasy, but, you know, not high fantasy. And I think it's a story that will resonate for ages.
Dan?
It's so funny. We get asked this question all the time as booksellers, and it is still, you always tense up at the thought of it, like, oh no. So I'm going to go with an old standby that I could have argued would make this list, and I kind of understand why it didn't, but I could still maybe argue, and that is Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel. It is definitely genre fiction. It is, it became very popular early in COVID because it was a book about a pandemic, but a very different pandemic. And what resonated with me then, I read it long before that, and then I read it again in 2021. And what resonated with me throughout is the sense of hope and optimism through the book, that there are these trials and tribulations, and it is still possible to make your way through and rise above it and be hopeful for what is to come.
Linda?
Well, I would say Stoner, as I said before, for all the reasons that I shared. I think in addition, you know, a really great book, a novel that I loved. I loved the how well it was crafted. That's Old School by Tobias Wolff, about a boy in a, you know, boarding school. And what it really it does is it examines the relationship between truth and lies. It's just also, you know, Wolf is such a incredible storyteller and craftsman and I believe he was the professor of George Saunders. So, you know, he's really a master and has written a lot. Most of his books are known as hit short stories he's done, really. This is one of his only novels. So
I guess it's my turn. I feel like I should probably throw in my two cents here. And I guess my pick is a reflection of the life stage that I'm at. So I'm raising two daughters. They're still in elementary school, but I was so, I don't know, disturbed, moved. I read this book like 2 years ago and it haunts me. Like to this day, I think about it. And it's My Dark Vanessa. I don't know if you guys have, you're nodding. And it tells the story, it's dual timeline. And it tells the story of Vanessa when she's like 15 and when she's late 20s. And about this relationship that she had with her high school teacher. And it does not make excuses for the inappropriate relationship that they have. But it's told through the eyes of 15-year-old Vanessa. And you understand how a young girl gets groomed into this kind of relationship. It is such, like, the number of times I wanted to fling that book across, like, the room. Because I understand why she's feeling the way she does. But at the same time, you're understanding why it's also wrong. It's such a difficult book. But I think every parent should read it. And I want to end our conversation with actually a clip from author and Atlantic staff writer Clint Smith discussing the Atlantic's list at the New Orleans Book Festival.
We are incredibly unique in the history of the world in that we are attempting to build a multicultural, racially diverse democracy and to have that project succeed in ways that it hasn't historically succeeded. And I think that having books that reflect the multiplicity, the plurality, the complexity of the American story, that reflect the things that we should be proud of as well as the things that we should be ashamed of, and that try to tell all of those stories. Again, not that one book is going to tell all those stories within itself, but I think one of the great things about a list like this is that you have so many stars that make up the constellation of what is America.